single-story houses breaks off at one point, and a well-kept garden of high shrubs and flowers takes its place. Tucked away behind the greenery stands a marker in memory of the two families whose homes had stood there. A mile or two away is the town's cemetery, a special section of which has been set aside as a memorial garden to the victims. It's a windswept setting, sobering to visit, above all when you learn that a large group of students from Syracuse University was on board in their late teens or barely 20. The memorials to them from bereaved parents are particularly affecting. Lockerbie is tranquil now. So are Glencoe and Scarpa Flow, Stirling Bridge and Bannockburn. The persistent paradox of tourism, very clear in Scotland, is that some of the most interesting and stimulating places to visit are also those in which people fought against each other to the death or spent their lives preparing to do so.
Lecture 15, North Wales.
The Welsh language is different from English and much harder to learn than French, Spanish, or Italian. In the face of English attempts to suppress it over nearly eight centuries, it has survived as a living language and is spoken by about a fifth of Wales's 3 million people. It's commonest in North Wales, where to enter any shop or any public space is to be surrounded by it, as much among children and teenagers as among older folk. Let me turn it over to Paul Meyer here, and he can explain further.
Road signs and public notices are given first in Welsh, and only afterwards in English. Luckily for us monoglots, there's no one who can't speak English too. And Welsh-accented English is lovely, musical, lilting, and emotionally expressive. Welsh includes lots of double Fs, double Ls, and double Ds, and dense clots of consonants. The most famous Welsh word is the name of a railway station, 58 letters long, which has become a minor tourist attraction in its own right. The sign takes up the old front of the station building, while on the station platform, another helpful sign gives a pronunciation guide. It goes something like this. Llanfair Pwllmyngyll. Goger, Hrindrobwll. Llantysilio, Gogogoch. It's usually abbreviated to Llanfair PG, and it means St. Mary's Church in the hollow of the White Hazel near the Rapid Whirlpool and the parish church of St. Tysilio with the Red Cave. How's that for a really specific set of directions?
Thanks, Paul. By comparison with Scotland, where the Gaelic language is spoken by very few people, but nationalism is a strong political force, Welsh nationalism is comparatively slight, but the language is thriving. Wales itself, whatever your language, is a lovely place to visit, hospitable, charming, scenic, and full of places that vividly bring to mind its turbulent earlier history. The Romans conquered Wales, but the Anglo-Saxons didn't. And by 1066, the year of the Norman conquest, two ethnically and linguistically distinct groups faced each other across the border. Offa's Dyke, built by one of the Anglo-Saxon kings of Mercia in the late 700s, is a long earthwork running from north to south, close to the current border. It consists of a wide ditch on the Welsh side, with the soil thrown up to create a raised embankment on the English side. The whole thing was once about 65 feet wide and 8 feet high, enough to create a severe obstacle to raiders. Centuries of erosion have worn it down in some places, but in others it's still distinct. A 176-mile-long footpath now follows it from the Bristol Channel to Liverpool Bay. Ruling two centuries after the Norman conquest, King Edward I of England was a handsome, swaggering bully who loved to fight, A man who went into towering rages when he didn't get his own way. Unusually tall, he was nicknamed Longshanks. He decided to conquer Wales in 1277 after years of conflict between Welsh princes and the English barons who owned the borderlands, the so-called Marcher Lords. The fiercest resistance to Edward's army came from Welsh chieftains in the mountains of the northwest. Edward responded by building a ring of castles around the mountains to ensure his own command of the lowlands and the seaports. He'd stamped out all resistance by 1294. Four of these castles have been designated as UNESCO World Heritage Sites: Conwy, Carnarvon, Beaumaris and Harlech. Today we'll stop at each of these castles and visit many other sites along the way. As you drive into North Wales from England, you'll come first to the walled town of Conwy, which stands on the north coast fronting the Irish Sea. Edward designed and built it as an entirely English colony inside Wales. He deliberately placed it on the site of a venerated Welsh monastery, whose monks he displaced, sending them to a new site 8 miles away. Conwy was built between 1283 and 1289 in the form of a triangle. The castle forms one of the triangle's corners. An almost continuous set of high city walls, very well preserved and partly on dramatic sloping ground, make up its sides. The castle was a state-of-the-art building in its day, designed to intimidate potential aggressors, featuring a strong series of towers that bulge out from the curtain wall to give defenders a complete field of fire against anyone approaching. Within the walls stands a second line of defence around the royal apartments. Even attackers who somehow broke through the first line of defence would be exposed to withering fire from secure positions. You're free as a visitor to roam around the battlements and to climb most of the turrets up extremely steep and narrow spiral staircases, holding on tight to rope banisters. The parapet or stone fence protecting you at the top of some of these lofty towers is inadequate. If you suffer from vertigo, don't go up. Whoever you are, tread warily. From the east wall of the castle, look out over the Conwy River, which is crossed here by 3 bridges. The middle one is the oldest. It was built by Thomas Telford between 1822 and 1826. Telford is a man I mentioned many times in this series, a great road, bridge and canal builder, and one of the most honoured men in the history of civil engineering. His Conwy Bridge is among the earliest suspension bridges in Britain. What makes it such a charmer is the fact that he's mimicked the castle's towers, creating a 19th century echo of the 13th century building. When the railway arrived at Conwy in 1848, another great engineer, Robert Stephenson, also took the hint. The body of his bridge, just to the right of Telford's when seen from the castle, is an enclosed iron girder structure. But the towers at each end are also castellated, though not so elegantly. Stephenson was working right on the edge of the mainland, and at one point his route had to pierce the old city walls, leaving a graceful crenellated arch that railway photographers cherish. Did anyone succeed in capturing Conwy Castle? Yes, but not by siege. Owen Glendower, the romantic hero of Welsh resistance, took it by a clever trick in the year 1401. When most of the garrison were at Sunday church, he dressed a group of his soldiers as carpenters, had them roll up to the castle in a wagon and talk their way in. The 2 sentries who'd been left to guard the castle fell for the trick, only to discover that they'd lost the castle. Then they lost their lives. It's a reminder that no castle is better than the men who defend it. There's more to see in Conwy than just the fortifications. The oldest dwelling in the town, probably from the early 1400s, is Aber Conwy House. Occupied over the centuries by merchants, officers, sea captains and a temperance hotel, it's been imaginatively restored by the National Trust and is open to visitors. it feels simultaneously ancient and solidly middle class. Each of the different rooms is furnished from a different era of its history, but the ancient timber beams are on display throughout, and the floors are delightfully uneven. Plas Mawr nearby is an equally fascinating Tudor townhouse, now decorated in the style of the 1660s. Down on the waterfront, where the seagulls call and there's a smell of salt, fish and seaweed, you'll find a tiny red building that's billed as Britain's smallest house. Hard to disagree with that claim, as it's scarcely wider than two people standing right next to each other. About 4 miles from Conwy is a beach resort town built on an elegant curving bay. English people pronounce its name Llandudno. However, the two L's at the beginning of the word should be pronounced fl, so try to pronounce it Llandudno. The seafront hotels are dignified Victorian places, built on the grand scale, and still popular among British holiday makers who want to stay in the British Isles. But the most interesting part of Llandudno is a huge headland called the Great Orm, which is protected from urbanisation. A tram climbs the hill using the same system as the San Francisco cable cars. Don't challenge yourself to walk up this hill unless you're in good shape. It's one of the steepest roadways in Britain, and it had me gasping for breath. Two-thirds of the way up, you come to a marvel, Great Orm's Bronze Age copper mine. The Victorians knew there was malachite, a greenish copper ore, in the area, and they sank deep mine shafts to get at it. Along the way, they also encountered some older tunnels, many of them filled with rubble, but thought little of it. Only in 1987, when the area was about to be paved over for a parking lot, did archaeologists discover that there was a labyrinth of tunnels at 9 different depths, bearing witness to large-scale ancient mining at the site. Radiocarbon dating established that the mines had been active about 1500 BC. Until this discovery, the conventional wisdom had been that there was no metal mining in England before the Romans' arrival in 43 AD. It's an exciting development in pushing back one of the markers of civilization in Britain. If you share my experience there, you'll find highly motivated archaeological workers on site willing to talk about their work. Spare a thought for the Bronze Age mine workers. They were trying to excavate a metal ore using primitive stone and bone tools, hundreds of which have been found there. Some of the tunnels are so small, twisting and cramped that they must have required child labourers. Today's healthy adult archaeological workers literally cannot enter some of them at all. You'll emerge from your own subterranean tour through the contorted galleries, feeling that your neck's been twisted, your elbows and knees bumped, and grateful that your head was protected by a hard hat. From Llandudno, drive about 20 miles inland to Snowdon, the highest mountain in Wales. It's just over 3,500 feet high and can be climbed in 3 or 4 hours. According to legend, the pile of rocks on its summit is the burial place of a fearsome giant named Rhitta, who tried to kill King Arthur, failed and paid the ultimate price. 3 of the lakes on the mountain's lower slopes each claim to be the one into which Arthur's sword Excalibur was thrown as his life neared its end. The 21-year-old William Wordsworth climbed Snowdon at night back in 1791 with a friend and local shepherd as guide. They began in heavy mist, but had the good fortune to come out above the clouds into brilliant moonlight. Or, as he put it in his long narrative poem, The Prelude, "A light upon the turf fell like a flash, and lo, as I looked up, the moon hung naked in a firmament of azure without cloud. And at my feet rested a silent sea of hoary mist. 100 hills, their dusky backs upheaved, all over this still ocean, and beyond, far, far beyond, the solid vapours stretched in headlands, tongues, and promontory shapes." As usual with Wordsworth, the experience led on to a meditation about the relationship between the natural world and his own imagination. To be above the clouds, hiking in Britain, is still a rare and exhilarating experience. For climbers of Snowdon today, there's an easy way and a hard way of doing it. The easy way is on the Snowdon Mountain Railway, a narrow gauge line that snakes up the mountain using antique steam locomotives. A Victorian scheme, it had to overcome the objections of landscape lovers who saw it as a desecration. It did overcome them. Parliament gave the nod, and the line was built in just over a year, opening in 1896. It ascends at a steady gradient of 1 in 7, or 14%, something an ordinary train could not manage, hence its use of a rack and pinion system. The good thing about the Snowdon Mountain Railway is that it's wonderful, like all steam trains, and that it gives people who would never otherwise get to the summit a chance to do so, where they can admire the super views. Hikers and climbers sometimes grumble about it even today, but it's now a venerable part of Welsh tradition. Besides, there are plenty of areas on Snowdon where ordinary visitors never stray, such as the strenuous rock climbs on which Edmund Hillary practiced before his first ascent of Everest in 1953. North Wales is honeycombed with narrow gauge railways, which can negotiate steeper bends than standard gauge lines and squeeze through tighter cuttings. Some have always been tourist-oriented. The Snowdon Mountain Railway is a case in point. Most of the others began life as commercial railways, linking stone quarries with the main lines, or with ports from which stone could be shipped abroad. Two superb examples of quarry lines are the Tallyflynn Railway and the Festiniog, which have long since converted from carrying rocks to carrying visitors. Enthusiastic preservation societies look after both, donating the necessary time and money to make up the shortfall in revenue that comes from visitors. I mention elsewhere in this series that maintaining old steam railways is a quasi-religious activity in England. The same is just as true in Wales. Riding the Festiniog Railway recently charged up my spiritual battery. Starting in Port Maddock, amid the distinctive smell of burning coal, our train rolled across the Cob, the harbour front wall, then chugged up into the mountains of Snowdonia National Park. Clanking, groaning and puffing, the engine poured out smoke and steam. On the sharp bends, the wheels sang and shrieked while the coaches jolted. Maximum speed can't have been much more than 15 miles per hour. The train's destination, Blenheim Festiniog, is a grim, no-nonsense slate quarry town, surrounded by mountains and spoiled tips. But the proud maroon engine cheered it up on arrival. Blenheim Festiniog's nickname is the town that roofed the world. In North Wales, the slate industry was big business for two centuries. So while you're in Snowdonia, the region, I encourage you to visit the National Slate Museum in the town of Llanberis. It stands on a flat patch at the bottom of a steep mountain slope, and you can see that, in its years as a working quarry, its quarrymen were steadily dismantling the mountain itself. The disused quarry is now a challenging arena for rock climbers. Slate is a fascinating stone. Under a skilled workman's hands, it will shear into thinner and thinner sheets, depending on whether it's designed for use on walls, floors, or roofs. Extremely durable, slate became the favoured material for building roofs throughout rainy Britain in the 19th century. Then demand began to rise throughout Europe. Slate from this quarry, Dinorwic, was eventually exported all over the continent. 3,000 men laboured at the quarry in 1900, which was alive with cranes, gravity slides, steam engines, and the sound of hammering. At the museum, you'll see the workshops and blacksmiths' forges where all the quarry equipment was maintained and repaired. Skilled slate workers reproduced the work of their predecessors, creating the necessary shapes and the necessary degrees of thinness as you watch. One highlight is the museum's water wheel, housed in a three-story building and providing what we would call sustainable energy to the whole complex. Also illuminating is a row of typical workers' cottages, of the kind occupied by Dinorwic's workers. They depict the possessions the miners' families would have lived with in 1860, 1901, during an era of a long and bitter strike in the district, and 1969, when the quarry era was coming to an end. They may not be as small as Conwy's smallest house in Britain, but they're certainly awfully tight and cramped. From Llanberis, go a few miles west to the coast. A narrow passage of water, the Menai Strait, separates the mainland from the island of Anglesey. Here stand two more of the famous castles I mentioned earlier. On the mainland side is Carnarvon. It's spectacular, even bigger than Conwy, and in better repair because of almost continuous habitation. By tradition, it's the site of the investiture of the Prince of Wales, the male heir to the British throne. Edward I bestowed the title on his own son, later Edward II, at Carnarvon, back in 1301, after completing the conquest of Wales. Queen Elizabeth II bestowed it on her son, Prince Charles, in 1969. He was 20. I was a 13-year-old schoolboy at the time and was one of millions who watched it live on TV. He had to give a short speech in Welsh and another in English. He also had to swear this oath to his own mother. I, Charles, Prince of Wales, do become your liege man of life and limb and of earthly worship, and faith and truth I will bear unto you to live and die against all manner of folks. A minority of Welsh nationalists demonstrated against the ceremony, but most Welsh people favoured the monarchy then, and still do today. On the Anglesey side of the Menai Strait, a little further northwest, stands Beaumaris Castle. Beaumaris means the beautiful marsh in Norman French, and sure enough it's built on low ground right by the sea. At high tide it could be supplied directly by ship, and the water also provided a moat. Its walls are so thick that there's a warren of staircases and passages inside them, which are fun to explore. Edward's architect, James of St. George, was continuing to improve his techniques, and here built one entire castle inside another. But if you arrive at Beaumaris after going to Conwy and Carnarvon, you'll be struck by the fact that it's not so high. The reason is that it was never completed. Work began in earnest in 1295 and at first advanced rapidly. But in 1300, Edward turned his attention away from Wales and geared up for an invasion of Scotland. The craftsmen at Beaumaris weren't paid and began to drift away from the site. Intermittent work was done in the following decades, every time a Welsh rebellion seemed likely, but stopped once and for all in 1330. Even unfinished, it's daunting. The first bridge across the Menai Strait was also the world's first full-size suspension bridge. I mentioned Telford's little masterpiece at Conwy. Here is his big masterpiece. He designed and built it between 1819 and 1826, and it's still in use today, carrying a heavy load of traffic in both directions on a busy road. It's the crucial link in the road he built from London to Holyhead, the A5. Suspension bridges were an important conceptual breakthrough because they used far less material than conventional masonry bridges and because there was no height limit. The deck of the Menai Bridge, 100 feet above the strait, permitted high-masted sailing ships to pass beneath. Across Anglesey Island from Beaumaris is Holyhead, the most northwesterly town in Wales, and the ferry port for Ireland. Just beyond the town, the land rises into high moorland that breaks off in dramatic sea cliffs. The area is honeycombed with the remains of ancient habitations. A series of stone rings on one of the hillsides are the remains of farmers' huts from the Roman era or even earlier. The cliffs are the nesting grounds of puffins, seagulls, cormorants and guillemots. One bird, the chough, a kind of crow with an orange beak, is rare throughout Britain, but is breeding well there, carefully monitored. The Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, the RSPB, has organised the area as a sanctuary. Not surprisingly, this is a good place to see ornithologists in their natural habitat, with their powerful long-distance lenses and rugged bad-weather clothes. South Stack Lighthouse stands on an island just offshore. It's a lighthouse worthy of the best adventure stories, because to get to it, you have to climb down 410 steep steps, zigzagging down the cliffside, then cross a girder bridge that spans a high chasm where ocean waves crash against the rocks. In the days when this was a swaying rope bridge, the trip across must have been even more heart in mouth. Even today, the wind, usually strong, moans in the girders. The lighthouse has been in use there since 1809. It's all white and just over 90 feet tall. Very imposing. When I visited as a child, there was still an actual lighthouse keeper. Now, regrettably, it's run by remote control from Essex, just outside London, hundreds of miles away. It's also haunted, a story I'll tell in the lecture on seafaring Britain. Heading south from Anglesey Island, drive across the Flynn Peninsula to the village of Thlenny Stumdwy, the home of David Lloyd George, the only British Prime Minister to come from Wales. The house where Lloyd George grew up is a modest little place, but is open to visitors. His widowed mother brought him up there with the help of her brother, a shoemaker and Baptist minister. The home radiates lower middle class respectability and a sense of moral rectitude. A picture of Abraham Lincoln hangs in the parlour. He was a hero to many mid-century British artisans for his belief in free labour and his opposition to slavery. The museum attached to the house includes the shoemaker's workshop and the Victorian classroom where Lloyd George studied as a schoolboy. Lloyd George began his career as a solicitor, but was a Member of Parliament for 55 years, from the time he was 27 until his death, always as a Liberal and always for the constituency of Carnarvon. An extremely gifted speaker, he appeared to have almost supernatural powers when it came to swaying audiences with a special blend of logic and emotion. A fascinating combination of energy, ability, charm, intrigue and ruthlessness, he was also an incorrigible womanizer, qualities that have fascinated historians and biographers ever since. He was Chancellor of the Exchequer in the government of Herbert Asquith in the early years of the 20th century, and ushered in the first elements of Britain's welfare state. At a time when working people had little access to health care and faced chronic insecurity if unemployed or too old to work, he recognised the wisdom of giving them a greater sense of security. It would diminish the otherwise powerful attraction of radical socialism. His leading parliamentary ally in those years was Winston Churchill, 11 years his junior, to whom he was a mentor. We think of Churchill as Britain's most famous conservative, but for 20 years he was a prominent liberal. Later they fell out. Lloyd George said of Churchill in these later years, he would make a drum out of the skin of his mother in order to sound his own praises. Stanley Baldwin, a conservative prime minister of the 1930s, who disliked both of them, remarked, Lloyd George was born a cad and never forgot it. Winston was born a gentleman and never remembered it. During World War I, Lloyd George was Minister of Munitions, charged with increasing production. He showed his superiority to his boss, Asquith, by brilliant improvisation to achieve it. An intra-party coup in 1916 ousted the easygoing Asquith, leaving Lloyd George as Prime Minister. His coalition government, drawn from all the parties, brought the war to a successful conclusion by the Truce of November 1918, again achieving prodigies of organisation and logistics in collaboration with French and American allies. But fissures in the governing coalition deepened after the war, and Lloyd George resigned from the Prime Minister's office in 1922. There are many statues of Lloyd George, one outside his childhood home, one outside Carnarvon Castle, one in front of the National Museum in Wales, and since 2007, one in front of the Houses of Parliament in London, a few yards from the statue of his old friend and rival, Winston Churchill. Several Welshmen have been leaders of the opposition since Lloyd George, but no other has yet become Prime Minister. Heading south from Llan y Stumdwy, we reach Harlech, the fourth and final of the World Heritage Castles I mentioned earlier in this lecture. It was built on a great rock outcrop beside the sea, but now stands nearly a mile inland because the coast has been building up in this part of Britain. UNESCO describes Harlech as one of the finest examples of late 13th and early 14th century military architecture in Europe. It too was built in the 1280s and was fought over during Edward I's wars in the 1290s. It was captured by Owen Glendower in the early 1400s and besieged by Yorkists in the 1460s as they fought against the Lancastrians during the Wars of the Roses. It was also the very last place in Britain to be held by royalists against the forces of Parliament during the civil wars of the 1640s. Restored and stabilised in the 20th century, it now welcomes visitors, most of whom will find themselves humming the old tune Men of Harlech as they stride along the ramparts and battlements. North Wales is often wet and windy. You need to be prepared with bad weather gear. But it's full of sights that bring to mind the area's turbulent history. Mountainous, picturesque, and dense with evidence of human activities over the last two millennia, it's also hospitable and welcoming. As I've suggested here, the great castles rank first among its attractions, closely followed by the mountains, the narrow gauge railways, and the rugged coastline.
Lecture 16, Cardiff and South Wales.
One of the great British films is Tiger Bay from 1959. Set in Cardiff, the capital of Wales, it's the story of a little girl played by Hayley Mills who witnesses a murder. Out of loyalty to the murderer, a friendly and kind-hearted Polish sailor, she refuses to tell the police what happened. The story is chock full of moral ambiguity from start to finish and contains what were, at the time, unusual scenes of multicultural life in Britain. Tiger Bay was the name of Cardiff Harbour. Already before 1950, it was one of the most culturally diverse places in Britain, with large numbers of Greek, Indian, Scandinavian, Polish and West Indian residents, a large transient population of sailors, and a high crime rate. Cardiff today is nothing like that, though it still has an ethnically and racially diverse population. Today it's the capital of Wales, seat of its parliament, but no longer a great industrial and shipping centre. The first thing to see there is Cardiff Castle, right in the city centre. The first castle on the site was built soon after the Norman Conquest, on an artificial hill, a fine example of the classic Mott and Bailey design. It still stands in the midst of the castle grounds, and you can climb two steep staircases, one up the castle mound and a second up the tower itself. Of greater interest, however, is the section of the castle that was converted, during the 19th century, into a pseudo-medieval fantasy house. The owner was John Crichton Stuart, the third Marquis of Bute. He may well have been the richest man in the world, though as a near contemporary of Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller, he certainly had rivals to the title. He was the owner of numerous South Wales coal mines, dozens of which dot the valleys whose rivers flow down to the South Wales coast. Welsh coal was the fuel of the Industrial Revolution, produced at a rate of 50 million tonnes per year in the late 1800s and early 1900s, distributed all over Britain and shipped in bulk to much of the rest of the world. Bute shocked the rest of the aristocracy by converting to Catholicism at the age of 21, when to do so still smacked of disloyalty to Protestant Britain. His tastes were scholarly rather than commercial. And with his architect friend, William Burgess, he proceeded to transform Cardiff Castle into one of the most elaborate and ornate creations of the Victorian Neo-Gothic revival. One room, the Arab Room, has a gilded ceiling of dazzling complexity with layer after layer of ornamentation. The ceilings of the office and the dining room are similarly intricate, with every inch heavily decorated, red and gold dominating. The family only spent a few weeks at Cardiff Castle each year, entertaining lavishly, but no expense was too high in the preparation of these rooms. In the Great Hall, too, every inch of every surface is decorated, with a wonderful carved wooden screen at one end under the minstrel's gallery. Over the fireplace is an elaborate painted carving, all in bright colours. It shows a medieval Count of Glamorgan on horseback, riding out from his castle, through the arch and under the portcullis. His wife, or at any rate a comely lady, waves her handkerchief to him from above. Heralds blow trumpets, decked with banners. In one corner, a man's head is visible through prison bars. This is a reference to Robert, son of William the Conqueror, who was imprisoned by the younger brothers who succeeded him to the English throne, William II and Henry I. Over doorways flanking the fireplace sit carved monks at their scriptoriums. All the walls of the Great Hall are painted with scenes of chivalry. The ceiling is vaulted and angels gripping heraldic shields stare down from the balustrade. Equally magnificent, or equally ridiculous, depending on your taste and your judgment, is the library. Over the fireplace are five carved figures, each one holding a tablet that bears writing in one of the world's main alphabets. Two Gothic arch doorways stand side by side at one end, their frames playfully carved with monkeys, two of whom have gotten hold of a book and are exploring its pages. Painted on the walls are cherubs or putti, each bearing the name of one of the Marquis's favourite authors. Here too, the dominant mood is one of exceptional richness and an absorption in a highly idealised past. Throughout the formal parts of the house, every inch is decorated with beautiful wall paintings, tiles and patterns. My personal view is that it's a great national treasure over which we should exult. What a good job that the early 20th century Philistines, who despised everything about Victoriana, didn't desecrate it. There's just one room, the drawing room, in which the 18th century interior has been preserved. It's decorous and decent, but will never set your heart racing or bring a smile to your lips like the Gothic rooms. During World War II, Cardiff, with its big port, was a target for German bombers, which inflicted a lot of damage. The city asked the fifth Marquis, grandson of the builder, to let it use the castle's immensely strong curtain wall as an air raid shelter. He agreed, and the area is now open as part of the castle museum. It's huge, a great long stone corridor where iron bed frames and wartime posters have been placed to give you more of a feeling of life during the Blitz of 1940 and 1941. The posters are themselves little gems, deadly serious at the time, but now nostalgic, about the importance of always carrying your gas mask, growing your own vegetables, and not gossiping about war news. My favourite is a Don't Waste Food poster, which shows a big casserole with Churchill's face above a saucepan with Hitler's face. The text reads, "Better potluck with Churchill today than humble pie under Hitler tomorrow." A powerful soundtrack of bombs whining down and exploding completes the experience. Near the castle stands a set of three impressive civic buildings from the end of the 19th century. The first is the Law Courts, the second is City Hall, and the third is the National Museum of Wales. They were designed to project the pride and dignity of Cardiff. It comes as no surprise to learn that they were paid for by the Marquis of Bute, though stylistically the City Hall is less medieval and more like a French chateau. It has a dome and a great tower, both impressive. Inside are romanticised statues of ancient Welsh heroes, such as Howel the Good, a 10th century warrior and lawgiver. Everything is elegant, white or pale brown, swirled marble, and spacious. The National Museum, Cardiff, another stupendous domed building, is next door. It too features great open staircases, massive central display spaces, and a radiant sense of its own importance. Among the paintings on the upper level are a collection of important impressionists. It comes as almost a relief to learn that these Van Goghs, Monets and Renoirs came not from the Marquis, but from a pair of rich, learned and charitable sisters, Gwendolyn and Margaret Davies. The daughters of another rich businessman, both born in the 1880s, they began collecting when the works were still new and controversial. They volunteered as nurses during World War I and later set up a house that was designed to be an arts centre. This house, Greginog Hall, in the central Welsh hills, is a pseudo-Tudor affair in black timber and whitewashed plaster, where annual music festivals attracted the biggest names of the interwar years, Edward Elgar, Ralph Vaughan Williams, Gustav Holst. The sisters' importance to the National Museum is that they donated over 200 major works, whose collective effect is to make Cardiff one of the centres for the study of French art in Britain. There's much to enjoy at the museum, including a thorough geological history of the area, a robotic stuffed mammoth, and high-quality dinosaur skeletons. I single out for your special attention a painting of Sir Thomas Mansell and his wife, Jane Pole, from 1625, by an unknown artist. Mansell was a rich South Wales landowner, a member of Parliament, and a courtier to King James I. His wife is much younger than he. They're both stiffly dressed in elaborate black-and-white costumes, but the way he holds her hand transforms the painting into a glimpse of tenderness behind the rigid protocol. Cardiff's civic buildings, backed by spacious parks, are close to the city's main shopping area, much of which has been improved by the exclusion of traffic. A mile away, down the aptly named Bute Street, and passing through an ugly 1960s-era development named Bute Town, you'll come to the harbour, where urban renewal is in full flower. As the British coal industry died in the 1980s, so did Cardiff Docks, becoming a desolate wasteland. The area's transformation since then is encouraging. The first thing to command your attention there is also the principal survivor from earlier days. It's the Pierhead Building, commissioned by you-know-who in the 1890s, and built in a mixture of styles, neo-Gothic, Renaissance and Neo-Jacobean. It was the business centre of the dockyards, now converted into a visitor centre, far more elaborate than its utilitarian function might suggest, with pinnacles, turrets, oriel windows and a fine clock tower. Even the gleaming tiles on the walls and floor are distinguished. Beside it stands the new Welsh Assembly Building. Devolution of power from London to the Welsh and Scottish capitals came in legislation of the 1990s and was the impetus for its creation. I mentioned in an earlier lecture that the new Scottish Parliament building ran about 1,000% over budget. This one came in at a sixth of the Scottish price, £70 million compared to £414 million, but was also late and also far more expensive than intended. Of the two, however, it is the better building. The architect was Richard Rogers, and it was opened by the Queen in 2006. You approach it up a series of slate steps and pass under its great canopy. On sunny days, the steps are just right for sitting to watch the passing scene. One section, the meeting place on the plinth, is a functional work of art by the sculptor Richard Harris. The building's great glass front bespeaks openness and transparency, while the undulating wooden ceiling above suggests the movement of sea waves. Inside there's a spacious modern foyer. On a recent visit I saw a Welsh choir singing there. And behind it, the council chamber itself. The great wooden supports which curve into the textured wooden ceiling give you the sense that you're under an immense and dignified mushroom. On the plaza before the assembly building is an artful monument to merchant seamen from the area who died in wartime shipwrecks. At first glance, it looks like part of the hull of a shattered boat, composed of metal ribs covered with riveted plates. But you realise on walking around to the other side that it's also a human face looking down into the water. It's an eerily effective way of blending the human and material tragedy of war. The artist, Brian Fell, who got the commission in 1994, taught himself hydraulic riveting to create the work's period mood. In the same complex, part of the area's redevelopment is a major performing arts building, the Wales Millennium Centre, from the beginning of this century. It includes an auditorium that holds nearly 2,000 people and two smaller concert halls for 250 and 300 people each, along with shops, rehearsal rooms, offices, and even some accommodation. The materials are all Welsh, including many different colours of slate. A metallic facade is the most striking element of the design, bearing a line of poetry in both Welsh and English. In these stones, horizons sing. As night falls, you realise that the letters are actually windows, so the light from inside the building makes the writing even clearer than it was in daytime. The architect, Jonathan Adams, wrote that it was meant to evoke the Roman custom of placing inscriptions on public buildings. The inscription over the entrance of the Wales Millennium Centre is a revival of this classical tradition and also a recognition of the formative influence of Roman culture upon our nation. We're lucky to have two languages, one that we share with half the world and one that belongs just to us. Words in songs, stories and poems have helped to make Wales the proud country that it is. In front of the Millennium Centre is a large open area, the Roald Dahl Plas. Dahl is the author of many wonderful children's books, such as The Big Friendly Giant and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Both his parents were Norwegian, but they lived in Cardiff, whose strong links with Norway are underlined by the nearby Norwegian Sailors' Church. Dahl himself was born in Llandaff nearby and baptised at the Norwegian church. This bowl-shaped plaza, often used for outdoor concerts, is named to honour his memory. Go north out of Cardiff and you enter the coal mining valleys that made Lord Bute so wealthy. Most of the mines have gone now, and this is an area of high unemployment. The remains of its mining history are all around you, though most of the slag heaps have now been turned into grassy hills, rather than being the ugly grey-black mounds of former years. In the lecture on industrial Britain earlier in this series, I described the Big Pit at Blenafin, a superb coal mining museum where you can go deep inside a disused coal mine with guides. A few miles away in the Taff River Valley is the sad village of Abervan, whose junior school was smothered by a landslide in October 1966. Nearly all the children in the village aged between 7 and 11 were killed, 116 of them, along with 28 adults. They were my contemporaries. I was 10 at the time, and this was the event that started me reading newspapers and becoming aware of the wider world. After knowing about it all my life, I finally went to see Abervan when I was 60. It's one of many places in Wales where you're always on a steep slope, up or down. It's easy to imagine the landslide, and hard to believe the folly of sighting the school right beneath the slag heap. The site of the school, Pant Glas, has been transformed into an elegant memorial garden. Queen Elizabeth II, who first went to Abervan a week after the tragedy, has returned three more times, most recently in 2012, to open a new junior school nearby. Half a mile along the valley from this garden is the cemetery, also on a very steep hillside, where 116 stone arches in two long rows give unity to the area where the children were buried. The graves themselves are a painful sight, especially those bearing photographs of some of the children, in some cases of brothers and sisters, both recorded as having died at the school. These South Wales mining valleys specialise in Methodism, male voice choirs and combative trade unions. They're also the source of many prominent Labour politicians. The nearby town of Tredegar, for example, was the home of Aneurin Bevan, probably the most famous and emotional socialist in Welsh history. Son of a coal miner, he too became a miner at the age of 13 and rose through the ranks of the Miners' Union. A spellbinding orator, he was a local leader during Britain's general strike of 1926, which was the closest Britain ever came to socialist revolution. And he won a seat in Parliament in 1929. As Minister of Health in the post-World War II Labour government of Clement Attlee, Bevan supervised the creation and launch of the National Health Service. In his view, no society can legitimately call itself civilised if a sick person is denied medical aid because of lack of means. Winston Churchill, whose Conservative Party opposed the National Health Service at first, quipped that Bevan was the Minister for Disease. Its success since then, however, has prevented politicians from either main party from attempting to dismantle the National Health Service, and it's become one of the unquestioned foundations of British life. Access to affordable healthcare, of the sort Bevan achieved, is now as basic a right as access to 12 years of schooling. In my own life, spent half in Britain and half in the United States, I found this difference one of the starkest between the two nations. Bevan himself was recently voted the most popular Welshman of all time. From the same town of Tredegar came Neil Kinnock, another miner's son. He led the Labour Party in the 1980s, struggling to keep its moderate and radical factions in harmony. He detested Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, and she despised him. They were polar antagonists on almost every question. Kinnock briefly featured in the American News in 1988 when Democratic presidential aspirant Joe Biden plagiarized one of his speeches and was forced out of the race in disgrace. Moving west from Cardiff and the mining valleys of South Wales, you soon arrive in Swansea. It was the home of the poet Dylan Thomas and is now the site of the Dylan Thomas Centre. It's housed in the old Guildhall, one of the most distinguished civic buildings in the city, centrally located and dating from the 1820s. The centre was opened in 1995 by ex-US President Jimmy Carter, who admired Dylan Thomas's poetry. Since then, it served as a museum of manuscripts and artefacts from Thomas's life, a conference centre, and a place that encourages new Welsh writers and holds regular readings. Another house, the Dylan Thomas Boathouse, a Loch Arn, another 40 miles west, is also a museum. A wealthy admirer, Margaret Taylor, bought the house for Thomas in 1949, and he lived the last few years of his life there, from 1949 to 53, to which era it has now been restored. The adjacent writing shed where he worked has been left deliberately messy. All around the table are screwed up pieces of writing paper, a shorthand way of suggesting the anguished writer's struggle to get the words exactly right. Dylan Thomas's poetry is beautiful and formally precise. "Do not go gentle into that good night, a villanelle," is a plea to his dying father to struggle against death rather than succumb to it. "The force that through the green fuse drives the flower" is an intricate meditation on the implacability of nature in giving and in taking away life. Fern Hill, by contrast, is a wonderful celebration of youthful enjoyment, commemorating the farm owned by his aunt, where he spent happy days as a child. Dylan Thomas was a schoolteacher's son, but he quit school early to become a journalist. Always an avid reader, he began writing excellent poetry. Much of his best work was done in his teens. He won a London Poetry Prize when only 20, began to publish regularly, and was recognised as a major talent while still in his early 20s. T.S. Eliot and other luminaries admired him, and he had a gift for drawing the patronage, support and money of wealthy and well-connected people in British life. The BBC asked him to give broadcasts in the 1940s, and he made a series of lecture tours of the United States in the early 50s. Records of him reading his own work, notably A Child's Christmas in Wales, were made in America and became very popular. In view of his reputation as a major Welsh poet, it's odd, listening to them, that he has no trace of a Welsh accent. To get the most out of that work, listen to Richard Burton, another famous Welshman, reciting it instead. Despite his genius, Dylan Thomas was an utterly irresponsible scoundrel. A reckless alcoholic, often blind drunk, irascible, argumentative, and an incorrigible womanizer, he borrowed money but didn't repay it, worked to avoid military service during World War II, and finally drank himself to death in his 30s. He sponged off the eminent historian A.J.P. Taylor for months at a time. Taylor hated him, but his wife Margaret was sexually infatuated with him. Thomas was also a fearful procrastinator and spendthrift, never dependable. If Byron was the 19th century's most roguish, swashbuckling poet, Dylan Thomas took up the mantle in the 20th. Southern and central Wales, no less than North Wales, is wonderful countryside. On the country's southwestern tip, for example, the Pembrokeshire Coast National Park was created in the 1950s. The park is made up of four sections designed to preserve an area of special geological interest. In fact, the geological term Cambrian comes from this area, where pioneering 19th century geologists found rich fossil beds, sometimes including evidence of the soft tissue as well as the skeletons of extinct creatures. Cambria was the Roman name for Wales, and that name gives us the term Cambrian, which refers to a geological time period when, quite suddenly, there was an explosion in the diversity of life on our planet. The Pembrokeshire Coast Path, suggested in the early 1950s and officially opened in 1970, covers 186 miles of coastal cliffs and inlets. Nearly all its sections are lovely, and nearly all are challenging hikes, because they require frequent descents off the cliff tops to cross little river valleys as they flow down to the sea. Don't worry about having to commit to the whole distance. A well-timed bus service enables you to walk short sections and then get a ride back to your starting point. Ronald Lockley, who made the initial survey for this path, was an eccentric Welsh naturalist who'd spent years on an offshore island tracking migratory bird behaviour and setting up observatories. His book, The Private Life of the Rabbit, educated his friend Richard Adams about rabbits' group behaviour as he was writing the classic 1972 novel Watership Down. The Preseli Hills in the northern section of the Pembrokeshire Coast National Park are the source of the famous blue stones from which Stonehenge is made. Stonehenge is 150 miles from here, and there's long been a controversy over how stones weighing 4 tons could have been quarried and then moved so far. One possibility is that, during the Ice Age, they were carried by the ice sheet and deposited much closer to the Henge site, such that they should be classified as glacial erratics. As always with Stonehenge, we're not quite sure. In any case, no definite quarry site has been identified. The Preseli Hills are themselves rich in Neolithic remains. Two of them appear to be burial chambers, in both of which a large rock has been carefully lifted onto 3 or 4 stone uprights. These are Carrig Cotan and Pentre Ifan. Man-made earth mounds containing tomb chambers are thought to have been constructed around them. Not far away is Castell Henlis, an Iron Age site, on which a set of prehistoric round houses has been built, where archaeologists try to farm according to the original dwellers' methods. The little city of St. David's is about halfway along the Pembrokeshire Coast Path. St. David is the patron saint of Wales. He lived in the 6th century and was the founder of a strict monastic order in the area. His favour in God's eyes was shown during a particular sermon he preached against the Pelagian heresy. All at once, the ground where he stood rose up and became a hill, after which a white dove fluttered down from heaven and settled on his shoulder. His remains, buried in the cathedral, became a major pilgrimage site in the Middle Ages. Pope Calixtus II declared in the early 12th century that 2 pilgrimages to St. David's were the equivalent of 1 to Rome. That was good news for the local people, who created a lucrative pilgrimage business. Even warrior monarchs like William the Conqueror and Edward I went to visit the shrine. That also means, of course, that the city went into decline after the Reformation. For your pilgrimage to Pembrokeshire, I recommend hiking boots and cameras. The mood of South Wales is different from that of North Wales. The area is more urban and bustling.